This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Well, hello, and welcome to show two of Letters from Kayfabe, and I'm here once again with Alan. How are you doing, Alan?
I'm great. How are you, Parv?
I'm very good. And, well, shall we just hit the mailbag straight away?
We'll be back with the mailbag. Oh, and no doubt the mailbag has just arrived.
Well, if a postman delivered like that in England, I'd fire him immediately.
I am excited to open up the mailbag, so let's see what we've got for our second show. And firstly, we've got Dear Alan and Parv, am I dreaming or did Hulk Hogan sometimes wear a helmet to the ring? And that's from Bradley D'Amato in Benslem, Pennsylvania. So, Hulk Hogan in a helmet, Parv.
Yes, now I want to say that he definitely did sometimes wear a helmet. I think memorably once against Sergeant Slaughter, and once perhaps even more memorably, he wore one with a fist on the top of it. Alan, have you got any more to say about this?
Well, yeah, the helmet fist. I've got a lot to say on it. We'll just say what Dave Meltzer said about it first. This is taken from the September 19th, 1988 Wrestling Observer newsletter. So he put, they're having Hogan wear a helmet with a fist on it so they can sell helmet replicas at Christmas time. So the helmet is playing a part in every finish because they feel they'll need to get it over by the Christmas shopping season. So, basically to describe this helmet... It's a piece of work. If anyone, by the way, bought this helmet, you've got to let us know. I think I would love to go out one day wearing this helmet just for the reaction.
I would like
get
a
off people.
Photo of you wearing the helmet, whether as a 14-year-old or now.
Well, Hogan referred to it as his war bonnet, this helmet, and it was brightly coloured, red and yellow, and it had a giant fist on it. Maybe this was the fist that SmackDown kind of used years later when they had the SmackDown Titantron with a giant fist over the Titantron. I don't know. But it was kind of modelled on the one that you would kind of see Romans wear, or as I like to say, Marvin the Martian, the one with the kind of brush on its head. Yes. Or brush on it. but instead of the brush, Hogan's variant had a fist on it. It was used twice in 1988, so this was around the time when Meltzer reported on it. There was first at the Boston Gardens, which was on September the 10th, and the results we have here was Hulk Hogan pinned Ted DiBiase at 13:30 with a leg drop after ramming DiBiase into Virgil, who was wearing Hogan's war helmet. So Hogan managed to get this helmet, take it off, put it on Virgil's head, then rub DiBiase into Virgil to get the win. So then the next night, so Hogan was on a run with this helmet, Hulk Hogan pinned Bad News Brown at 9:21 with a leg drop after headbutting Brown with his war helmet as the referee was knocked down. Moments after, my God, moments after Brown used the helmet as a weapon himself. So Hogan used it twice there to, you know, victorious against main heels in 1988 in Bad News Brown at the Meadowlands and in the Boston Gardens against Ted DiBiase. So what are your thoughts on this war helmet?
Well, I mean, it's bizarre, isn't it? It's really strange design, I think, with the fist on the top. I don't want to be rude, but you could say it looks a bit like something else. You know, from a distance, you wonder, well, you know, it's almost like Hulk is asking you to call him something else.
No, I think the thing that I heard about this was, it was always told to me anyway, that Vince was rightly so concerned about Hogan's hairline at the time, and he was starting to look older than he actually was. You know, and at this time, some younger-looking, muscle-headed guys were coming in, and maybe this may have been a Hogan idea, and he went along with this, because you had guys like Tom McGee, who, you know, were knocking around, who were more impressive looking than Hogan, who had more athletic ability than Hogan.
Right.
Not necessarily could work better than him, but Hogan may have felt, I need something to make me look younger so I don't look like this old guy, and maybe the helmet was that thing for him. I don't know.
So around this time, he started wearing the bandana in a more full-on way as well, did he not?
Yeah. So I think the two are linked. I think Hogan was very, very conscious of his hair, and I believe that heels weren't allowed under, you know, decree from Vince to actually mention that in interviews because they didn't want to age Hogan at all.
Is my memory deceiving me, or did he also not later wear a military helmet when he was feuding with Sergeant Slaughter?
No, I think he wore the helmet during the MSG match, didn't he, in 91, you know, the Gulf War match?
Yeah.
Because he was wearing at the time kind of army combat gear.
But not the an actual military helmet.
Yeah, it was more of a military helmet to play into the kind of Iraqi versus US deal that they had going on at the time. I mean, Hogan recently mentioned the helmet, you know. I don't know if you know this. He mentioned the fist. I can't say it without laughing. The fist helmet on Chris Jericho's podcast. He was talking about Rowdy Roddy Piper not wanting to put people over, and they had a similar problem with Bad News Brown, who also wouldn't really comfortably put people over, even if it was Hogan. So Hogan basically said they used the helmet as a way for him to agree to lose. Bad News Brown's finisher at the time was a ghetto blaster, wasn't it?
Yeah.
His finisher. So this was a move. This was a helmet that could kind of block that move. But Hogan didn't mention anything at the time about it selling any replicas of the helmet. But he has acknowledged it recently. So, yeah, the helmet was awesome. It's something that not many people remember, and I think everyone should at least Google Hulk Hogan fist helmet. But don't do it whilst you're at work. is what I would say. But that is basically, like we mentioned in the first episode, this fist helmet is well and truly at the edge of the cheese platter that is the WWF.
Yes, indeed. This has been a very cheesy journey. Okay, so. What else is in the mailbag?
Well, after that was a great start. The old fist helmet. Hopefully, we've got some people can chime in and comment about that. Maybe add a bit more to it. But the second question we've got on today's episode was: my favourite wrestler is Dino Bravo. Yeah, I thought he disappeared after the Hulk Hogan and Earthquake feud of 1990. But my friend says he saw him wrestling against Bret Hart in 1992. Can you tell me more? And this is written in from Chadley Crisolo again from Norwalk in Connecticut. So, Dino Bravo, what was he up to later on in his kind of WWF run?
Well, I've looked into this, and it seems like after being away for a little while, Dino Bravo came back in late 1991 with dark hair once again. And I saw him have a number of different matches against fan favorites. Against villains. He seemed to come back as, as a good guy, basically. He was against Louis Spicoli. I saw him against the Mountie in Montreal. And it seemed like he was gearing up for, what we call a babyface run in late 1991. But then, for whatever reason, nothing really happens with that. And he then goes on the European tour, to Germany and to, that big tour they did at the early part of 1991. And that is where he had the match against Bret Hart. And I remember that very well because it was on the European... Or I think it was on one of the Coliseum Home videos. Was it European Rampage or maybe...
The 92 one that you're referring to. I know that there was a match shown, or one of the shows from, I think it was Sheffield, was shown live on Sky at the time. And that was actually his last ever appearance in the WWF, was that televised match. I think was against Bret Hart. But brown-haired Dino Bravo, I mean, he first came in, I would like to say, early 1987 as the Canadiens champion. And he was aligned with the Dream Team at the time when he had the brown hair. I don't know if you recall this. He was on WrestleMania 3 as the second for the Dream Team, and he this was when Brutus Beefcake split from the Dream Team, and he left with Luscious Johnny V. This is Dino Bravo and Greg Valentine. So he came in with brown hair. He dyed his hair bleach blonde, and he had the bleach blonde hair for a good 4 years or so, 4.5 years. Which would have done his hair no good, probably. And that may have been one of the reasons. You don't know why he went back to the brown look. I think with the brown look, he looked, after going from blonde for so many years, it was a bit different. He looked a bit washed out. His career was a bit washed out as well by this point. But from my findings during this, Parv, was he did get some TV wins in 91. He beat Shane Douglas, who we talked about last episode in July.
Yes.
On TV. And then he didn't do much, but then he did a Superstars taping in July. And I think personally that this maybe just may have been shot for local TV in Canada, because it was the segment where he turned up with dark hair, he interrupted the Mountie and punched him in the face to turn babyface. But he was still working on the road as a heel after that. So I personally think that the thing with the face turn was more of a localised thing. I don't know what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, well, I saw a TV interview from a Montreal event against Jacques Rougeau, where Raymond was, you know, the interviewer. And he was definitely a babyface in that promo. But it seems definitely during the European tour, he is back as a heel, because he's tagging with people like... we mentioned one of them, didn't we? Was it that Shane Douglas match? Hold on. I saw...
No, it would have been 92 if he was doing the European tour. Douglas would have left the promotion by then.
Just give me one second here. I'm trying to remember exactly who the match was against. Yes. He tags with Colonel Mustafa in 1992 against the Legion of Doom in a match... which I believe took place in this country, in England.
No, it did. Yeah, that was one. And then, I mean, the crowd were rabid for that match.
Really hot crowd for that one.
Yeah, I mean, that stood out to me. I mean, at that time period, wrestling the UK, that's been touched on in other podcasts from other people, including myself, I think, with you on a podcast in the past, Parv, where we did kind of discuss that at length. But we would eat anything up in that time period. Everyone was over as a megastar, be it from whoever was a prelim guy all the way to the top of the card, and that showed during that clip.
Yeah, well, I mean, even Colonel Mustafa got on the mic during that, and he even had a bit of... that actually felt like a bigger deal than it should. You know, Dino Bravo and Colonel Mustafa versus Legion of Doom, you'd think that would be a two-minute squash, wouldn't you? But I don't know, I had more heat than you'd ever imagine.
No, and I think the interesting thing that I discovered during looking at this run that Dino Bravo had, that he actually had an announced retirement match in 92 versus the Barbarian on January the 20th in Montreal. But he then was back in April for the European tour. And you notice this with a lot of guys throughout these European tours. They'll fade or come off TV, but then they'll be brought back for a tour. I've seen this with Rick Martel. We've seen this with Hulk Hogan in 93.
Yeah.
And we're seeing this with Dino Bravo. And I think that is because they're still a star and they still need to sell tickets in a new market. So I think there's a pattern there emerging with those three, at least, as an example. And why do you think... Sorry, go on, Paul.
I would just want to know the thinking that Dino Bravo was going to help sell more tickets in France, Germany or England in 1992. But carry on.
Well, yeah, he was a guy, and he was a guy that was known, you know, that people would have seen on tape. So I think that was the main kind of reason for it. But why do you think, Parv, that Vince had someone like Dino Bravo around for so long? Because he was the shit. He was boring. He didn't have, I can't name one standout match that he had during this entire run. So why would Vince like to keep him around?
I think Dino Bravo was kept on the books for as long as he was, because of those special Montreal shows that they ran every once in, you know, he was a draw in Montreal and he was a draw in Toronto. And that was the only reason, as far as I can tell, Bravo was on TV for as long as he was, because they could run Hogan versus Bravo up there and it would always, you know, do something. They could even run Jacques Rougeau versus Dino Bravo there and it still meant something to the local fans. That Montreal market is quite interesting, actually, in general, because, I don't know if this is a bit out of our time frame, Alan, but did you know that Jacques Rougeau defeated Hulk Hogan once upon a time?
Yes, I think that was October 97.
As late as 97, Jacques Rougeau meant something to those fans there, enough that he could believably beat Hogan in a match. So
yeah, I mean, they drew a monster gate. I think he was, you know, 20,000 for that. I think it was 90. It could have been 96. Well, 96 or 97, but I knew it was October time. But that was huge, and it was a market for WCW, and they exploited it correctly. And I know that Jack Rougeau had matches with Carl Ouellette, Pierre Ouellette, also in Montreal, that drew big numbers. So there was definitely a market there. But I think also Vince loved, you know, your big muscle guys with giant steroid physique. So as long as Bravo looked like that,
the other thing, and this is a little bit outside of the box, is that over the years, Vince did seem to have a special fondness for old guys who worked for his father. And one of the things that people forget about Dino Bravo is that he was a tag champ with Dominic DiNucci in the late 70s. It's a run that people, you know, typically don't remember or isn't made a big deal of because, like you said on the last episode, you know, history prior to 1984 is ancient history, right? But, you know, Bravo was an old kind of Vince Sr. guy, maybe was the sort of guy that Vince would like to keep around. Because, you know, he employed him in 1985, and then he brought him back in 87, and then he brought him back in 1991. So, yes.
Yeah, I think he wasn't great, though, and he...
Not the best.
Basically, that's it. How I can describe Dino Bravo, he wasn't great.
The alternative, of course, is that he was just scared of him because of his gangland connections. There's the other possibility.
Yeah, I think he met an untimely demise, unfortunately, but if you deal in what he was dealing in, smuggled cigarettes with people who are quite powerful and dangerous, then, you know, things like that may happen. So, sorry that was the way he went, but as a worker, wasn't great, but he still had a place because of the Montreal connection.
Don't forget, he is Charlie Cascola's favourite wrestler, so he must have made an impression on some people.
No, he has at least someone. Everyone's got, you know, there must be a favourite, you know, a fan of every single bad wrestler out there, and Chadley is Dino's, so I'm glad that we could answer that for you, Chadley. So, yeah, is there anything else you want to add about our friend Dino Bravo?
I think we should move on.
Yeah, I think we should. So we've got another question, Parv, luckily from another listener. So we've got this question here from Jason Weber in Fall River, Massachusetts. And Jason asks, I remember watching WWF Spotlight in 1989, and they always called Sean Mooney Ian Mooney. Why? And what was going on? So Sean Mooney, Ian Mooney, what the hell was going on at this period, Chad? Sorry, that's Chad who asked the question, Parv. Go on.
This is quite bizarre. And luckily, somebody out there in the World Wide Web has decided to edit together all of the Ian Mooney pieces so you can watch them all in one, which I did, Alan. It took 20 minutes, but it felt more like 3 hours. Did you sit through all of them yourself?
The only one that I actually could bring myself to watch was the one he did with Sherry, where Sherry was not at the start of it playing the normal Sherry Martel you get used to, which was quite interesting. But he presented Wrestling Spotlight, which, if you want to explain, Paul, what was Wrestling Spotlight on the WWE programming?
Okay, so around this time, so around 1989, the WWF had their television split between a cable, which was the USA Network, and syndication. The syndication A show was Superstars, the B show was Challenge, and the C show, I believe, was Spotlight, which would basically just kind of run highlights from the other two shows and maybe once in a while stick out some exclusive content. But mostly it was presented from, I would say, quite a bare studio set, fronted by Ian Mooney with Sherry. But they would have, you know, sometimes Vince would do it, sometimes Gene Okerlund would do it. I think Mooney was the staple for most of the run of Spotlight. Of course, over on the cable side, you had Primetime, All American. And did they have a C show as well, or was that it?
I think that was it for the Primetime run that I could think of off the top of my head. I'm sure
until Raw came about, and when they had three shows for a while. So
yeah, in 93. I mean, as far as my understanding, the Ian Mooney character, it was Sean Mooney playing Ian Mooney. It's some weird WWE running gag thing. Was it to you? I mean, was it ever explained, or do you know why they said Sean wasn't there and Ian was there?
Well, I mean, it's not like they really took... It's basically they just call him Ian. He announces himself as Ian Mooney. Sherry calls him Ian. There's a kind of ongoing story that... I don't know if you watch this, but Sherry at one point tries to make a move on Ian Mooney. And she says, oh, you know, Ian, actually, I've given you a hard time and you're quite a good looking guy. And then Ian Mooney's like, yeah, well, I've been meaning to say for a while, I actually like your style, Sherry. I like you a lot. And then she turns on him and says, you know, the Macho King's not going to be very happy. Wait till he finds out. So there's this ongoing thing that the Macho King hates Ian Mooney because he's trying to sleaze on Sherry. It's one of the most bizarre, like, and this, as far as I know, was never mentioned outside of Spotlight.
So no, it was its own little universe and own little storyline, which I liked when shows did that.
So yeah, the Ian Mooney character, I believe, is entirely A, contained Spotlight, and B, had an ongoing issue with Savage. So what would happen is that every once in a while, Savage's music would hit. And as soon as Savage's music hit, Ian Mooney gets out of Dodge and the show finishes. So it's like every Spotlight ends with Ian Mooney kind of running away from Savage. So it's kind of bizarre to think about. But it's not like they ever say, I am Sean Mooney's, you know, twin brother. So that's one thing. The other thing is that it's not like Ian Mooney is in any way substantially different from Sean. He's exactly the same.
Well, I thought the way that it's kind of spoken about, that it was more slightly heel.
Who, Ian Mooney?
Than Sean. Yeah, when I watched it, I didn't pick up on that at all.
No, he's exactly the same as Sean. The only difference is that he has a slight sleaze on Sherry.
Well, do you realise, though, that Sean and Ian are basically essentially the same name because they both derive from John? So, I don't know if that was why he was called Ian. I have no idea. But this reminds me of weird WWF things. I mean, this whole show's about kind of these kind of things. But I don't know if you remember a reference that they used to say about Jack Tunney had a secretary called Emily Hotbody. They used to reference this during some of the shows and in magazines. And it was a fictitious thing, obviously. And they did this more for themselves than the fans. But I don't know if you... Have you ever heard of Emily Hotbody and that being referenced?
I have heard of Emily Hotbody. Another kind of little inside thing. I guess they used to get bored when they had to produce all these hours, endless hours of content. And they had to keep themselves entertained, maybe. But, one thing that just occurred to me, Alan, is... You know, some people have called Waluigi from the Nintendo universe the most postmodern character of all time.
I haven't heard that, but Waluigi, is that the evil Luigi?
So, you know how Luigi is basically a simulacra of Mario?
Yes.
He's like a sprite double.
Yes.
And then Wario is kind of like a dark version of Mario.
Yes.
And then Waluigi is like a kind of... the Luigi version of Wario, which makes Waluigi a kind of... I mean, it's hilarious if you look it up. If you type in Waluigi postmodern, is a kind of thing like he has no reason to exist at all. Like he's a character who only exists in like Nintendo sports games to make up the numbers and things like that. And it's occurred to me that Ian Mooney might be like the Waluigi of the WWF universe.
Well, I can guarantee that reference has never been made before, the link between Waluigi and Ian Mooney.
Well,
so bravo.
Fans, this is what you've come to this show for. So.
But yeah, I mean, going back to the Emily Hotbody thing briefly, that was Jack Tunney's supposed secretary, according to Jesse Ventura, who was actually, it was based on Emily Feinberg, who was Vince's personal secretary, and who was actually also a part-time model in the WWF magazine catalogue section. I don't know if you knew that, but that's delving really niche, but that's basically referencing who Emily Hotbody was.
And how often would they reference Jack Tunney's secretary? Like for what?
Well, it was only Jesse Ventura that referenced him. It was throwaway lines, so it was, you know, I can't name the actual times, but I do remember hearing that reference two or three times at least. But I like it when they do things like that. Maybe that's because you and I are hardcore fans, and it's just giving us that little extra thing to kind of find out about, but I like those touches myself.
All right. Well, thanks a lot for the mailbag. And now we're going to go over to JT Rosero for the event center.
Let's take it out of the event center.
Thanks, Parv. Thanks, Alan. JT Rosero here, back with your event center here in episode 2 of Letters from Kayfabe. And this week, I wanted to take a little bit of a different look. We're going to head over to 1992. And as many fans of the World Wrestling Federation, or wrestling in general, may know, the company had a working relationship with SWS out of Japan for most of 1991 and into 1992. Of course, we had the infamous match there with Earthquake and Katao with the broke into a shoot fight of sorts. But many may not know that towards the end of 1992, they actually flipped their relationship and started working with War. And they had a really big card on September 15th, 1992. The main event, Ric Flair defeating Tenryu in a best 2 out of 3 falls match at 38-35. Both men were counted out in fall number 3. Also saw The Undertaker battling King Haku, which is a pretty interesting match in late 92, especially since Haku, of course, is no longer with the company. Animal defeated the Beverly Brothers. Kabuki defeated Takahashi Ishikawa. And then some other matches there in the undercard, also one that featured the Ultimo Dragon. So a very interesting card that happened in the fall of 1992, which is a very interesting time in general for the WWF. A lot of change going on in the company. Ric Flair had just regained the World Wrestling Federation Championship from Randy Savage, heading into a bit of a tumultuous fall as they were starting to weed out a lot of the stalwarts in the earlier generation. Of course, Hulk Hogan had vanished in the spring. Ultimo Warrior had returned, but he was in his final months as well as the steroid trial began to loom over the company. British Bulldog on his way out. The ascension of Shawn Michaels and Bret Hart and many other new stars. Yokozuna. Doink was just, you know, debuting at that time. So 1992, a very interesting time. Overall, it's a very strong year for them on pay-per-view, but the fall of 92, tons of change going on. And of course, you can read and hear all about more from that year in the WWF in general on many of our shows at the Place to Be Nation, on all of our networks available to you on iTunes, whether it's PWO, PTBN, our Place to Be Nation, or Place to Be podcast feed, or PTBN Pop. And of course, some of those shows, you know, Between the Sheets hit on many different years, and they cover WWF in depth along with all the other promotions around the world. Myself and my partner, Scott Griscolo, with the Place to Be podcast, reviewed all those pay-per-views back in 1992 as well. So plenty to check out, plenty of written pieces as well for you at placemination.com. Sure, check out all of our feeds, like I said, on iTunes, as well as on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr. I'm going to throw things back over to my lads over in England, that's Parv and Alan, as they're going to be looking at the changing look of the WWF from the mid to late 80s to wrap up our show here this week. And next week, we head back even further, looking at Roger's Corner and Victory Corner with Roger DeBoard, so be sure to check that out. Interesting, of course, the precursor to what's, I don't know, known today, the highlight reel and many other talk shows, great lineage that we'll be touching on in future episodes as well. So I'm Just Rosero. That's this week's Event Center. Take care.
Well, thank you very much for that, Justin, from the Event Center. And now we're going to go back to the mailbag one last time to see if we've got any longer topics, Alan.
Well, this is a doozy, this question, when this came in. So I'll read the question. It's, the look of WWF seemed to change a lot from when I started watching wrestling in the mid-80s to how it looked in the early 90s. How exactly do you think it changed in this time frame? And that's sent in from Charles Lossing in Little Rock, Arkansas. So for Charles, what do you think, Parv? I mean, there was a massive shift, and for a variety of reasons, but when would you say the changes started?
Well, this is a very interesting question, because the first thing I'll note is that I actually went back and wanted to watch the very first episodes of WWF TV from 1983, from when Vince Jr. took over, just to see what exactly he did to change the state. I mean, Vince Sr. had a very staid television product. You know, I don't know if you've seen any old early 80s or 70s television, Alan.
Yeah, I've seen briefly, not as much as you, because you covered it in depth on the Titans series of podcasts, but it's a completely different shift from what we're seeing at this point.
So, I mean, just to paint the scene, you'll typically have Vince there, because he was the host of Championship Wrestling, or the other show they had was All-Star Wrestling. So he was the host, and he'd be wearing either a canary yellow jacket, which is actually something that Vince kept, was the jackets. You know, because that's a little thing, actually, that I think is worth mentioning, because they don't do it these days in wrestling, where everybody's got the same uniform. So you know how you've got Oakland, Vince, and Lord Al, I want to say, they all wear the same suit.
And they've all got the WWF logo on the suit.
The WWF logo on the suit. So that is actually something that he did keep from his father's time. But just to paint the picture of what the Vince Senior TV looked like, typically you'll have, you know, it came from a studio in Hamburg. It was, you know, very, like, it's a kind of boring product, you know. It looks drab. There isn't any lights. There's no music. And they all of the interviews happen in front of the ring. So Vince will stand there with a microphone, and maybe he'll interview Lou Albano with two of his guys. And then the next person who he's going to interview, who might even be the opponent of the tag team that he's just interviewed, will then come in and he'll interview them. It's really a very different ball game. In 1983, Vince really started to change those things quite quickly. He brought in, first of all, there was something called Victory Magazine, which started to feature a bit more. Then he started to move away from just having it in the studio all the time to actually bringing you matches from arenas, which is something I think that we take for granted these days. But, you know, the look of a studio show versus the look of a show that's coming from a packed out arena, that makes a, you know, that, what does that tell you as a viewer, Alan?
It tells you that the product's hot. It tells you it's a must-see product. There's thousands of people there all cheering on faces and heels versus, like you said, the shows that the TV they used to record in Hamburg, which was, it was a slightly bigger studio setting, if no one's seen it, than, say, what they did in NWA at the time, Mid-Atlantic. It was different. It was slightly bigger, but still, it was. How many people would you say would have been in that arena or in that setting?
I would say between 2,000 and 4,000, something like that.
Yes,
but it's got a very specific feel. You know, you've still got old Joe McHugh there. You know, the old boxing announcer from literally the 1930s. you know, it's just a very different style of show. And in fact, if you know, fans who grew up in the mid-80s want to have a look at some of that stuff, I would actually go and have a look, because it's very interesting to see Hulk Hogan's very first television appearance. Because the way Hogan comes in is that Bob Backlund is attacked by a bunch of heels. I want to say Iron Sheik is involved. And Backlund is attacked, and Hogan is the person who comes in and makes the save. And they even acknowledge Hogan's previous run, because obviously he had a heel run in 1980. But really, that is the very last kind of tail end of the old Vince Sr. TV, is Hogan coming in and saving Backlund. And it really, from that point, it doesn't take long for Vince to, obviously he acquires the Georgia TV, he acquires the St. Louis TV, and they have the wrestling at the Chase slot. And so the first thing is he transitions to that, you know, and you notice little things like the logo, the WWF logo. Before about 1983, you don't see that at all. You don't see it very often on the MSG broadcast or anything like that. You take that for granted now, don't you? The idea of the logo on everything. Well, that's one of the first things Vince changes. You know, you see that logo a lot. But, and this is where I think where Charles was going with his question, it still wasn't really standardized. So, you know, there were some holdovers of the old TV. The MSG shows look a bit different from the, you know, typical championship wrestling. And I think there's a moment where Vince starts to standardize things, to insist on everything being the same. You know, every single guy on the roster having a gimmick, having a logo, the WWF logo always looking the same. You know, it's the one that we know, the metal one, the metal WF. And I would actually pinpoint it, if I was to be very specific, to the launch of Superstars in 1986. That, to me, feels like the birth of the WWF that we know from that, you know, the, in terms of the look. And if you think of those Superstars credits, where the WF logo is kind of, you know, the world is watching, and you see the, you know, the rock music comes in, and it's floating through that, what is it, like a sky, like a thunderstorm?
Well, yeah, there's different ones. I kind of looked at this, and the original kind of WWF intro was, I mean, this may have been more for the Coliseum home video releases, was kind of like a Star Wars entrance where they had writing, and they were talking about the Pancratic Games of years gone by and the Greek Olympics and how it's formed into the modern day wrestling that we're seeing now. So you would see that. And then in 1985, I think it changed to the WWF logo, like you discussed, the metal kind of block one, where it was loads of colour flowing into the logo to form the kind of colour scheme that you used to. And then the one after that was the one where the WWF logo was flying through, looks like a very Hollywood type Grand like the Grand Canyon or some sort of thing similar to that, where it kind of flows in and it goes up into the sky and it looks quite cinematic, and the tagline, the world is watching, and makes it bigger and better than seeing the other products. And I think it's quite an interesting point that like you touched on, was putting the WWF logo front and center. They wanted to associate pro wrestling with the WWF, and I think that was a really important tool to help with the expansion of association there, that WWF equals wrestling and everything else isn't quite at that level.
Yeah, and it's just occurred to me while you're talking, one of the other big, I mean, it sounds tiny now that I mention it, but I think it's a big thing in terms of presentation, is the shift. Do you remember that old kind of digital yellow writing that you see sometimes?
You mean the font, the one that they would use for Howard Finkel, and he'd show it in that writing when he's talking?
Yeah, and, you know, it's like kind of like very old-fashioned, almost like teletext or...
Yes,
you know what I mean?
It was basic to type in. It wasn't the font or the kind of... Yeah. I know exactly what you mean. It's hard to describe, but I think the second one, it had a couple of lines under it.
Yes, and then it goes to proper branding. And I do think there's a... I would say by 1988, so by the time that you have somebody like a DiBiase coming in, or a Mr. Perfect coming in, by that time, I think there's a very much a kind of formula. You know, everybody's got a gimmick. Everybody is introduced with a series of skits. Everybody has got iconography that, you know, so when you see a dollar sign, you know it's DiBiase. When you see the towel, you know it's Perfect. When you see, and he even started to do it a bit earlier. So, like, he gave Terry Funk the branding iron. Would be an obvious example. So when you see the branding iron, you know it's Terry Funk. So all of these sorts of things, I would say, are changes I would point to between the mid-80s and the early 90s.
Well, they used other things as well, I felt like. They would use crane cameras more. So when they would pan around the crowd and then kind of float in to the commentators, either behind a green screen sometimes, you know, looking like the packed house, or they were on... you know, a kind of stage, so it would pan to them. And I feel in like 1986, 87, the presentation was very baby blue in colour scheme. Right. I don't know if you felt that. The ring was baby blue, the referee was baby blue, the mats were blue, the entranceway was kind of a blue colour.
Yeah.
I think that was the kind of colour scheme at the time. And like you said as well, they had the logos, so at the start of every single match, each wrestler would have their own unique kind of avatar or logo. So the Islanders would have like a volcano erupting and things like that. And they all had their individual one. And I think that was good for the merchandising aspect and the branding of each wrestler. So everything tied in into a little package as we went further.
Even down to a font. I mean, if I say to you the Mr. Perfect font, I think you can picture exactly the lettering I'm talking about.
Yeah, it was the fancy kind of lettering, basically, that was used. So, no, I can picture that now. And it still does, it shifts as the late 80s get on, though. But the other thing before we mention that, you'd still see the matches that would come from some of the arenas, so you'd have like the Maple Leaf Gardens, that was still distinctively different from, say, MSG and from TV. So when they showed these matches, it stood out more like a sore thumb, because especially with, I think it's Maple Leaf that had the ramp went all the way up to the ring.
Yeah.
It was raised, like in WCW. So that was still present, and they weren't able, or they didn't feel like they wanted to, make those arenas look more generic, you know, like all the ones filmed for TV.
Yeah, the one other thing I'd say about the mid-80s period is that I feel like in 1985, or even in for most of 1986 as well, that you'd still see, how can I put it, you'd still see segments that looked kind of cheap. I'm talking about, like, imagine a wrestler being interviewed by an interviewer, call it Ken Resnick or one of these guys, in front of, like, a curtain, and it just looks cheap, you know? And I want to say that by 1988 or 1989, that would never happen. It would always be the green screen, or it would always be something that didn't look two-bit in that manner. I mean, I'll give you a good example. That draw for the King of the Ring, the Jack Tunney one, I mean, that looked terrible. That looked cheap to me. And I feel like if that draw had happened in 1989, it would have had more pizzazz around it.
No, I think there was definitely some upgrades. I think they did try and move more to a standardised background, but there was occasions where it did happen, and like you said, later on it didn't. So in like 86, they would have the, again, blue background with the WWF logos all running down next to each other. And then what you'd see later on is the green screen, or that kind of faux locker room. And I think they did that more in the early 90s, where they would have the heels and the faces, and it looked like a slightly different locker room, but it always looked like the same one, regardless of where they were.
Oh, that's right. So the faux locker room, it's kind of, you take it for granted, don't you? But yeah, you're right. The faux... I picked your Ultimate Warrior in there for some reason.
I picture like Sean Mooney interviewing someone in there, but you'd always have that locker room. But is there any other examples of the production not being as great as we move further into the 90s that you can think of?
Well, I want to say that there's definitely a change around 93 where you start getting more neon lights, I want to say. Like, the launch of Raw, it feels like it brings a different look again. You know,
you had the video screen starting in late 92 on Superstars, and I think that was on Raw as well, yeah. When Raw starts in January.
You know the WF, which is in the neon lights?
Yes.
You don't see that before about 93, I would say, or late 92. Another big change that happens is that Primetime moves from being in that, you know, the old studio with the phone that you'd see Gorilla and Bobby in.
Yeah.
It moves from that to the studio setting with Sean Mooney and Heenan in about 91. And then you get the panel. And there's something about that 91 studio that is a bit... I mean, if I was to point to a backward step, it might be that 91 studio that looks a bit cheap and... Like, that crowd never seems that big, you know, it just looks a bit rubbish, that prime
time. Well, that was all the employees were dragged in for tapings after they'd finished work, which, you know, I don't think they would be best pleased. They want to get home to the wife and kids, not sitting there watching Vince McMahon in his shell suit, doing skits with Andre the Giant and people like that. But I think the 92 one looked gorgeous, where they had the big long table, where you'd have two heels, normally Bobby Heenan and Mr. Perfect on one side, and then two random faces, like they brought back Hillbilly Jim.
Yes.
To do this. And you had Vince at the head of the table. Very symbolic. Vince was overseeing the kind of everyone's chatter. And I think that was my favourite kind of set, in a way, because it didn't look cheap, and it looked different. You'd never saw kind of that kind of setting to present, you know, wrestling matches before.
No, I would agree. And maybe on a later show, we'll return to that question of the panel specifically, Alan, because I think there's quite a lot to talk about with that. Because I've got very fond memories of the panel as well.
No, that was basically when my fandom started with WWF. Would have been mid-91, so you kind of saw that creeping after the Vince kind of studio setting. But the other thing with the change after this, I know this is a really interesting topic, and we could probably do a full show on it, but with time constraints, we're going to cover it now. But the changes I noticed was the smaller arenas. So we're starting in 93. You'd see it was taped at venues, you know, for the TV, for Superstars or, you know, Challenge, whatever. It would have been 4,000 seats for arenas rather than 8, 9, 10. And I think that was linked to the kind of downward popularity of the product at the time.
Yeah, one thing I really noticed watching some early Raws was that Manhattan Center. That's got a very specific feel to me, the Manhattan Center from, I think they always tape Raw in the same place, didn't they?
Yeah, the Manhattan Center, they used a lot in 93, and then they still went back to it as late as 97. I remember the infamous ECW invasion in 97 that was at the Manhattan Center. But the Manhattan Center had its own charm in a way, but for me, and maybe lots of other people like myself, I was used to this bigger arena setting, and I felt to me it was a downgrade. It was a perception to me that they could only fill these size buildings. I mean, it was a hot crowd at first, and it was different. It looked different. So obviously they wanted to position Raw to be a different TV product than what they previously had. But I just felt it was a downgrade. You could see the back of the room, and that's always for me. You should never be able... Well, no, I don't believe this now. Wrestling's wrestling. But at the time, I didn't feel you should be able to see the back of a room in a wrestling show.
Well, look, the weirdest thing is that you can see the ceiling, which sounds bizarre, but like you pick a random superstars from 88, 89, 90, and they're in big, big arenas all the way with hot crowds, and all of a sudden you've got, you know, typically like, I don't know, IRS versus Jim Brunzel or something, and you can see, you know, you can see the ceiling, so... Yeah,
they did use it to its advantage, the Manhattan Center, because they did some outside on the street segment. So I don't know if you remember the whole 1-2-3 Kid running away from Razor when he nicked the bounty, the $50,000 bounty.
He had
a legit concussion after doing a move to the outside where he crashed and burned on the floor.
I mean, we could probably, like you said, we could probably do a whole show on the early Raw, because I think it's an interesting topic. But one of the things that I think they were really going for was a different feel. You know, they had Rob Bartlett there, who is this kind of comedian. And I think that the whole idea was that this is going to be like a show almost for a slightly kind of more savvy urban crowd in a way, which considering what was on the card seems a bit ridiculous, but it's almost like the Raw was, I don't know, positioned to be cooler somehow. So something to think about.
Yeah, Raw being cooler, I can get that, but then you're watching a match between Doink and Bob Backlund.
Yeah, so there's an odd disparity between the kind of in-ring product and the way they were trying to position that as this Manhattan show, really.
And also, just the last point on that would be, they positioned it like this cool one, and I do agree, but I am proving examples that in a way it still wasn't, because they'd have the ring girls, and some of the ring girls were attractive, shapely, and they sometimes used these bigger women. I don't know if you remember that. I don't know if they were... like the Rossetti sisters.
Right, okay.
You know,
yeah.
In the 80s. Yeah. They're kind of that size, like the Roly-Polies, if you remember them in Britain. I don't know, they were more of a Blackpool staple. These older kind of middle-aged women in swimsuits. It was weird. It was different, and it stands out to me. So do you want to touch any further on this question? So where do you feel after this point we went, briefly?
Well, I want to say that the product starts looking darker. You get more like black spaces, less colorful, in terms of the way the studio looks. And I think that may be because they were dimming the lights on the crowd because they didn't want to show the empty seats, maybe. But at the same time, the product itself seems to get more and more colorful, which is, again, the two things are going in slightly different ways. But, you know, you've got these... Like, I always think of Doink versus Bam Bam Bigelow, or the bloody, what are they called? The Godwins.
Jeff Jarrett, he was another colourful one in his earlier run.
Yeah, so you do get these more like luminous greens and bright colours on the actual product, but the look of the whole thing seems to be darker to me. Darker colours, darker lighting in general, and even the sort of and less formal. I don't know if we want to talk about Todd Pentengill here, but I feel like you know how I was saying about every, you know, Lord Isle, Oakland, Vince, they'd always be either in a tuxedo or in that WWF suit. And now you had Pettingale wearing a baggy t-shirt or a leather jacket with an earring. And then you get the likes of Doc Hendricks coming in, or Johnny Polo, or
Stephanie Wyatt.
All of these, it just seems to be like a casualization of the way everything looked.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, I don't know if you remember the TV show that they started. I think it would have been 93, 94, WWF Mania. Do you remember that show?
Vaguely.
I think that it was Stephanie Wyatt at one stage with our friend Todd Pettingale, and they filmed it in the old WWF production kind of area.
Right.
Where they later filmed Livewire. I don't know if you remember. Where you'd see the kind of tapes spinning in the background, randomly dubbing stuff or doing what they're doing.
Yeah, the place where, it was an old Sean Mooney hangout, wasn't it? That area.
Yeah, he hung around there for video releases more. So yeah. It wasn't the one where you saw the background that Gene Oakland would do, where he would do the event center and things like
no,
that.
No, I'm
that.
Thinking like the WrestleMania 9 countdown comes mainly from that. You know, with the bit where Kevin Dunn is there and he passes Mooney a video, you know.
Oh, with the creepy Kevin Dunn look. Yeah. Yeah, so it definitely changed there. I mean, getting back to what I said before, the latest example of bad production was 1997. I don't know if you can remember when that was, Parv.
What have you got in mind?
They decided to air the WWF European Cup from Germany on Raw, the full show. So it was, I think the final was Bulldog versus Owen. I think it was Fantastic Match or Brett versus Bulldog. There was a combination of one of those three. It was, the crowd noise was just kind of like in a vacuum, and it was filmed like, you know, when they would take a one camera shot to a house show to film a title change, like the one with Diesel and Bob Backlund in 94.
Yeah.
It was filmed like that, but it was on Raw in 97. I think around February time. It was around the time where they ran the Manhattan Center the week before, the week after for the ECW thing, because that's why the ECW guys were there, because they needed to fill the show up. A live Raw, because all the guys were over doing a tour at the same time in Europe. So that was a time where it looked really dated, really bad. But luckily, the match quality was excellent, so it wasn't, you know, as bad as it could have been. And then after that point, we get into more the traditional kind of look that we're used to now, which is the long rampway, the Titantron, and this kind of look that's now not really shifted for nearly 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, in fact, 97 is weird as a kind of transitional time in general, where you still get... When's the last kind of old-school, like, Blue Cage? I honestly...
I would like to say that you were still doing the Blue Cage in 97, because they had the... Was it 97 where they had the Mankind elbow drop at SummerSlam?
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Against Triple H. And I think they had October 97 or September, and In Your House, where it was like three-way cage match where you had Ken Shamrock involved, I like to think. And I think that was still the old blue bars rather than the chain link one. But I think after that point, into 98, we started seeing, we didn't see the blue bars anymore, and we went to a completely different, you know, kind of, presentation, the Raw is War, explosions and pyrotechnics and things like that.
Yeah. Yes, I want to say that there is one other change as well, isn't there? Just before it becomes, you know how the logo is the kind of, you know, the scruffy Attitude Era one where it's just kind of been written?
Yeah, the scratch logo.
The scratch logo. There's one a little bit before that where it is the old-fashioned WWF logo, but it's a little bit kind of tilted a bit. I guess you'd call it the new generation one.
Yeah, that was the new generation logo, so that was like 96, 97
I associate it with In Your House and Pettingale. You know, they're kind of like where they were kind of going for that teenage audience, but it was really like in a little bit of a lame way.
And that was when they were started with the grand claims that the were for over 50 years your leading brand in sports entertainment. So if you did the maths, they were saying if for over 50 years, and this was in 96, 97, yeah, 96 time, maybe a little bit earlier, that the 1963 was when the WWF formed. So we're talking 30 years. So they're adding more years on there to try and create an image that they are the number one brand in wrestling.
Yeah, there's some odd things. Cause I remember, like, Fred Blassie randomly, like, has some... Doesn't he have some bits around that time where they're doing kind of, like... They were weirdly appealing to history at certain bits. Like, in some ways, Brett's entire title reign is a little bit of a throwback as well. It's kind of, like...
I can see that.
Looking forward as well as looking back.
I can see that with Bret Hart. I mean, the one thing that Bret Hart did, which harks back to years earlier, was defending the title more often and on TV. I don't know if that kind of plays into that kind of old school mentality that he's fighting champion.
Yeah, I mean, I've said it before, but I think Bret is you could see him as like an update of Backlund. And it was actually interesting that Backlund was around during that time. But maybe these are all things that we will get to on future shows. But to go back to the original question, if you were to pick a date as to when the product definitively looked different from the mid-80s to the early 90s, what would the year be, Alan?
So are we going now from the kind of baby blue to more of a total standardized one, or from more getting out of the darker, dingy-looking, cheap-looking kind of early 80s?
No, I think from the early Vince Jr. to the late Vince, to the kind of classic era, I guess I'd call it, or the when I think of what does WWF TV look like from the 1980s, I'm there, and it's kind of 88.
I would start late 86, maybe, and I have mentioned to you when we've discussed about presentation in the past, because it's a really interesting topic, that maybe 87, but I used to remember getting WWF kind of tapes years later that Sky used to show in 86 in the UK, and it, matches that stood out to me were like the Machines versus Bundy and Studd and things like this, and this was in 86, and it was very much... a big audience, and it was very well lit. That's one thing that stood out. They used to light up the audience because they were showing off the, you know, had sellouts. But realistically, I think more of a computer game look. So if you went back and watched one of the computer, you know, the WWF computer games or the arcade games that you would see in the late 80s, early 90s, I think that sort of image would be fully in effect, I would say, in 88.
Yeah, that feels like when it's all set, and it, to me, it feels like it stays the same from 88 till about 93 when Raw starts coming in, late 92. I would say that's the time where that look is really cemented. But I think that a lot of us fans are more familiar with that time because there's such an emphasis on pay-per-views these days where we tend to look back, you know, well, WrestleMania 1, 2, and 3 are done with no gaps in between. So people tend to look back and they look at WrestleMania 1, 2, and 3, but then you slow down because then you've got the SummerSlams and the Survivor Series and the many, many Coliseum home videotapes, and they're all, like, there's so much more content that was released on home video between 88 and 92 than there was between 85 and 87, 88. Would you agree with that, Alan?
Oh, definitely. I mean, they pushed the boat out there, and they're having... I mean, Saturday night's main event, I mean, we've not really touched on that. And that's another thing that changed, you know, from the earlier episodes in 85 to later on. And that's, again, something... I mean, we may, you know, off-air discuss revisiting this topic, but I think there is so many changes, and it's so interesting to see Vince's vision of what pro wrestling should be presented like. And I thought, like we've touched on, I think the peak of what he saw it as was your late 80s.
Yeah, I would say by the time Warrior is champ would be the kind of everything's in place by that point.
Oh, God, 1990, yeah, we're well there by that point. Because there's some interesting things, just we'll keep this topic. I mean, we'll have to cut it short in a minute, but do you remember watching the Survivor Series from 87 and 88? I think it was from the Rosemont Horizon.
Yes, I've seen that show, yeah.
The way they were presented was, it was quite a dark arena, where there would just kind of be these rows of lights at the back, where the stairs were, right in the upper bleachers. And that looked different to more of the other, you know, shows that they did for pay-per-views as well. And maybe that's because of the arena, or more so than anything else, because it was done twice. I think the film, they had the 87 and 88 Survivor Series at the same venue. So I think that stood out to me. But I think everything else was standardized. And I think it looked great, and I still think now it holds up.
The one other thing that we haven't touched on is the sorts of wrestlers that you'd actually see. I feel like a guy like Dick Slater, he was working for WWF in 86, 87 sort of time. I feel like the likes of a Dick Slater would not be making any cards in 1990.
Dan Spivey.
Dan Spivey. Just like kind of territorial wrestlers, or even like a Ron Bass, or any of these guys who were just kind of like not Vince creations. You don't really see them on the cards after about 87, 88. You know, it's much more your, and even if they are older territory guys, they're going to be brought in with a radically different gimmick, like Skinner, say. You know, he's never going to be Steve Kern. Or even like Matt Bourne comes in as Doink. You know, he's never going to be Matt Bourne. Or even like Big Josh, you know. So I feel that's another difference that happens, that you don't see any of those kind of older school guys so much after the time. Would you agree with that?
No, I think you're right there. I think they did phase a lot of things, you know, in later into the 80s, everything wanted to be a Vince creation, or they had a gimmick associated with it, or an animal, or a logo. And, you know, the other guys, they faded into obscurity, or a lot of them went back to NWA Jim Crockett. Your Dick Slaters later on, Dan Spivey turned back up there, and even people like, you know, the Iron Sheik, knocking around in WCW in 89, 90. I mean, you've covered that at length with Chad on Where the Big Boys Play. And, you know, there's completely different method, kind of visions of what you're going to present your product. I preferred, as a kid, in the magazines, where I got this book, and I don't know if you ever saw it in the early 90s, called Championship Wrestling, and it was a photo book by George Napolitano. And it was available in the UK as well, and they had pictures from WWF, and you noticed they were far shots, because WWF really liked to control who would take photos for their shows, and it was mainly WWF for their magazine and things like that. So it'd be far shots, but you see the crowd, and see this, that, and the other. But for the NWA Jim Crockett ones, it was more gritty. Even like the ring post look like they had paint chipped from them. You'd have smaller arenas, you know, the guardrails, the paint would be off them. Things wouldn't look quite perfect, and it looked more gritty, and it stood out as different. And I think, I don't know if that was done on purpose or not, probably not, because it's WCW association in a way, but I think it distinguished between WWF and Jim Crockett, that one was gritty, real, realistic, where one was made for TV, kind of more fake. Would you agree?
I definitely agree. It was more sanitized, the WWF. And I really think that was such a conscious decision. Another thing that we really must wrap up now, Alan, but another thing that we didn't touch on properly was Hogan himself. Because I feel like the Hogan of 84, 85 is very different from the Hogan of 1988, 89, 90. Where, you know, the earlier Hogan, you'd see have blood matches, he'd be bleeding, he'd be having gritty, long matches with people like David Schultz or Bob Orton Jr. or any of these sorts of, you know, old Southern guys. Whereas by 88, 89, you feel like every single Hulk Hogan match is going to follow a particular trajectory, and it's, you know, it's not going to be gritty. It's not going to be bloody. It's not going to feature lots of action. It's just going to be, well, you know, you know a Hogan match. So I feel that there's a big change in the way Hogan is presented as well. from.
Of course, and he's basically in the yellow and red, but beforehand you see him in baby blue, you see him in white. So that kind of all links in together, that there was a standardized yellow and red Hulk Hogan. You would never see any other colours, whereas previously you'd see him, as I said, in different colours. So, as you said nicely, we could talk about this a long time, but we're running out of time quickly here. So is there anything you want to add before we wrap up the show, Parv?
No, why don't we tell listeners how to get in touch?
Well, you can, easiest way to get in touch with myself would be on Twitter, and you can get me on Alan_cheapshot, Alan spelt A-L-L-A-N. And how can we get you on Twitter, Parv?
I'm at Jerry Von K on Twitter. You can also get hold of us on Facebook. That is the PWO PTBN Podcast Network. Get in touch with us there. You can also try emailing through the Place to Be Nation website. I will warn you that in 4 years I've checked that twice. So, you know, but when I did check it, I was very grateful to see I did have at least 30 emails over the years. So maybe in another 4 years I'll check that. So, yes, join us next time for Letters from Kayfabe.
See you later.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ian Mooney, along with Queen Sensational Sherry, and welcome to WWF Wrestling Spotlight. Now, Sherry, I know how much you enjoy introducing the superstars in the program. Why don't you go ahead?
No, you go ahead, Ian.
You want me to do it?
Sure, go ahead.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm sure. Go ahead.
Okay, Jake the Snake Roberts will join us.
Yes, he certainly will.
Also, Bret the Hitman Hart, he's going to take on a big favorite of yours, Mr. Perfect, in a great featured matchup.
A perfect match, don't you think?
All right, Sherry, what's going on here?
What do you mean?
Why are you being so nice?
Well, Ian, maybe I've misjudged you. You know, maybe you're not such a bad guy after all once I got to know you. You're not bad looking. You seem to have a pretty nice person there. You know, nice hair.
Well, Sherry, since we're on the subject, I really have to admit something here. I mean, I've always been a very big fan of yours. I mean, I like the way you dress, the way you carry yourself,
you
the makeup,
really?
The whole... I mean, it really, really works for me.
You like that, do you?
I do.
Well, let's see what the Macho King thinks about it when he hears everything that you just said.
Let's not get crazy here,
I'm gonna
Sherry.
I'm going to get crazy. We'll let the Macho King see what he thinks.
Why don't we go to a match involving rugged Ronnie Garvin? What do you mean Macho King?